integrity in each of the services is also critical to a strong military. General Amos, I have become friends with Major James Wyrick, United States Marine Corps, who I sincerely believe is a man of integrity. Did you fear Major Wyrick at any point?
My name is James Wyrick, and this is Military Justice, my podcast about the system of justice that governs those who protect our nation. Welcome back to Military Justice. Thanks for joining us again, and a special thanks to our good friends at The Great Courses Plus. Because of their kind sponsorship, Military Justice is back on the air. Today we have a friend of the show, Brian Buffard, and we are discussing a recent Air Force case. Also, you can hear Brian and his radio show. I will put links to that radio show, Uncuffed, in the show notes. And I hope you enjoy the discussion I had with him. And again, you'll hear more about this later in the show. But again, thanks to the great people at The Great Courses Plus. Now on to the interview. I'm joined again today by Brian Buffard. Brian is a former Navy judge advocate and now practices civilian and military defense law. Brian, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
And it's been a little while since you've been on the show. Can you give us a little refresh for new listeners?
Well, I guess since the most significant thing that I've had going on with me professionally since we spoke last was the Waco cases, the Twin Peaks biker massacre from back in May of 2015. We've finally gotten some justice there of a sort.
That kind of ties in a little bit to the case where the Air Force case we're going to talk about, Vargas, today.
Yeah, I think it does.
Yeah, in the Waco case, you had the district attorney that was interfering with the outcome?
Yeah. Well, he was actually interfering from the initial minutes.
Oh, yeah, I should say, beginning with about the in the parking lot of the Twin Peaks restaurant and bar.
Yeah, just to give a quick nutshell for your listeners, May 17th, 2015, there is a shootout at Twin Peaks Restaurant in Waco, Texas. There are hundreds of people there. There's a lot of banditos. There's a lot of Cossacks, and then there's some other smaller clubs. And some indication that the banditos and the Cossacks were beefing over something. But anyway, you know, most of the people are there peacefully and are just sitting there eating lunch, you know. Some violence kicks off in the parking lot, and there are nine people laying on the ground. So cops are there, and cops are, by and large, they are doing the right thing. They are doing their investigation. They are, you know, determining, you know, who the witnesses are, talking to them, and all this kind of stuff. And importantly, what they did and what they were in the process of doing was they were treating the vast majority of these people, and I'm talking 150 plus of these people, they're treating them as witnesses. You know, there's no indication that they fired any weapons. There's no indication that they engaged in any violence. And so, you know, some of them have knives and things like that that are legal. And basically the police are just taking them and throwing them in a pile. They're not trying to create a chain of custody so that they can prosecute these people later. They're not reading them their rights. They're questioning them about what they saw and all that, because again, they're not being treated as suspects.
Right. So you have a pretty full parking lot of people. You couldn't treat everyone as a suspect. It's just from the logistics standpoint, it would seem.
Yeah. Logistically, it was a nightmare, I'm sure. Because they, you know, like you say, there are tons and tons of people. They're initially not sure who's doing what. There's officer safety concerns and all that. So they're just basically trying to get a handle on the scene generally, and they're investigating this what certainly appears to be a capital murder case, and they're going about their business. Well, enter one Abel Reyna. He is the elected, or was the elected, district attorney of McLennan County, the county in Texas where Waco is the county seat. So he comes down there, and I'm not going to say that it's completely unheard of for an elected DA or for a prosecutor to go to a crime scene, but your job, if you're doing that, it's a bad idea to do it, but if you're doing it, your job is to keep your mouth shut. Your job is to just observe. So maybe at best you can present your argument to the jury down the road better because you've seen the way things are laid out. Reyna very quickly determines on his own that, hey, this can make me famous. So he starts, no kidding, taking control of the police investigation. So there's dozens of officers on the scene. There's assistant chiefs. There's detectives, you know, different, you know, specialized units. Everybody's there. And everybody is on the same page. We're treating the vast majority of these people as witnesses, and we're building cases against the people who were committing the violence. Reyna says, no, arrest them all. Arrest 177 people. I can prosecute them. I can get convictions. So there's some pushback from the police. They're like, no, we're not doing that. We're doing this our way. He gets the actual chief of police on the phone, who's not in Waco. He's on the East Coast visiting family at that time. But he convinces the police chief, yeah, tell everybody to do it my way. And sure enough, they do. So they arrest 177 people. They use a cookie cutter pre-printed arrest warrant. You know, these arrest warrants are supposed to be individually tailored to the evidence that explains why this person is, you know, has probable cause that they committed an offense.
Right.
They use the same one. They just have a blank at the top and they just fill in people's names. You know, it's absolutely ridiculous. They're all charged with first degree felonies, and they are all set by a justice of the peace who's in Reyna's pocket. They each get $1 million bonds. Now, I've been practicing for over 20 years. I've never seen $1 million bond in any case. I'm not saying they're impossible, but you know, they're almost unheard of. So,
and especially to have over 100 in one swath.
Oh yeah. I mean, this is just a complete goat rope, because what happens is, you know, they arrest 177 of these people. They indict about 150 of them, or a little more than that. And I guess what he didn't really take into account is if you are going to have 150 cases, you're going to have 150 defense attorneys, and we're going to put our heads together and figure out the right way to attack this issue. So fast forward, it's been almost 3 years. Last November, at about the 2.5 year mark, they had the first trial. There has been only one trial in the intervening almost 3 years. And it was a hung jury that was very, very close to a not guilty, you know, and that was the DA's handpicked case to go.
Right.
So that was a blow to them. But I think the bigger blow to them was, you know, we started getting a lot of information from a lot of different sources about the political corruption that was going on in that office, making cases against campaign donors go away. You know, that type of thing, just sort of running the office for your political ambition rather than to represent the state of Texas in criminal cases. And we got a lot of this stuff out, and a lot of this stuff was ready to go. And we had a hearing to recuse the DA's office because Reyna made himself a witness when he went there to the scene and basically acted like a police detective, you know.
Right, he just becomes a factual witness.
That's right.
Just about things like whose knife was that?
Yeah.
And what was the position of the body? Right.
Well, not only that, but you know, typically you would call the lead detective.
Sure.
And you would ask him questions like, explain why you found probable cause to arrest my client. Well, you know, the detective just followed Reyna's orders.
Yeah, he says because the DA told me to.
That's exactly right. So to get the actual facts out, we would have to call the DA, and the courts ultimately agreed with us on that. They're like, yeah, this guy made himself a witness. You can't be a witness and counsel in the same case, you know, so he's got to be recused. But before we got there, you know, we've got this hearing set up, and at this hearing, there's just going to be a lot of bad stuff coming out about Reyna, and we're putting Reyna on the stand. He's under subpoena. And so the day before we're having this hearing, he dismisses my case. So my client is the first of all 177 of these arrestees to have his case dismissed. And what he did was he he dismissed my case. He recused in another case. And then he also dismissed like a handful of other cases, about 15 or 20 other cases. And apparently his goal was to make the news cycle believe that, hey, the story here is just we're reevaluating cases and dismissing some of them. But everybody was able to really clearly see through the ruse, because the only reason why he dismissed these cases was to avoid this hearing, you know. So he's doing all this right before the Republican primary back last month in March. And the voters saw through it, and he got beat in the primary. He's an incumbent. He's been reelected twice. He got beat in the primary 60-40, which wow. Down here is a pretty huge margin. So he's a lame duck, and I believe.
And your client's in the clear, right?
My client's in the clear. He's not going to try any more of these cases. I don't know how he can. And what he's done, and this I think this is kind of how this will tie into to the Vargas case a little bit, is he has probably, well, I think definitely screwed up the prosecutions that in this case might be righteous. You know, the people who actually did engage in the violence, because he's going out there and mucking around with the investigation at the time. So all of the innocent people, I think, are going to get off free like they should. And I think the guilty people are going to avoid being convicted because of this naked political ambition.
Yeah, either avoid being convicted or even tried at all, right?
Yeah, I would not be surprised if there were no more trials, you know, because how can there be on many levels, you know? A lot of us were just laying behind the log for years. I mean, once I talked to my client and took a look at the evidence, I was convinced that there's just no way they can convict my client of anything. And a lot of other people, I mean, hundreds of attorneys, you know, a lot of people have been laying behind the log. And I did that for a while. And then I just finally got fed up with it and went on the offense and got a good result.
Excellent result.
Yeah.
I'm a firm believer that learning doesn't stop after school. I've spent my lifetime learning, and I'm always looking for ways to dig deeper into topics that fascinate me. That's why I've really enjoyed the Great Courses Plus and its wonderful new course, American Military History, From Colonials to Counterinsurgents. Now, in my previous life, I was a Marine officer, and now I'm a retired Lieutenant Colonel. Throughout that time, we spent a lot of time learning about especially the military history of the United States and world military history. And I can tell you, from listening to this program from the Great Courses Plus, I learned a lot more. It's hosted by General Wesley Clark, retired four-star general, and he explores the three centuries of America's wars. He's a great storyteller. It's done very professionally. And also, it's got some great graphics and some really good video. I thoroughly enjoyed this course, and I know you will too. This is the perfect course to get started on the Great Courses Plus. Additionally, you can choose from one of their other more than 10,000 lectures. With the Great Courses Plus, you'll get unlimited access to stream their entire library. So that allows you to test out a course. If you like it, keep going with it. If it's not a subject you're interested in, you're not committed to it. So it allows you to explore things that you might not have explored before. You get to learn from leading professors, experts about any topic that interests you: history, psychology, law, science, even hobbies like photography or playing the guitar. Watch or listen anytime from anywhere. I want you to enjoy the thrill of learning from the Great Courses Plus also. I've arranged a special limited time offer for listeners of Military Justice. You get a full free month of unlimited access to enjoy any of their lectures. But to start your free month, you must go to my special URL today. To sign up now at thegreatcoursesplus.com/justice. Again, I recommend this. I'm positive that listeners of Military Justice will enjoy this. So please go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/justice. Yeah, let me tie this back, because I think you're absolutely right. We see a lot of overlap between this and this Air Force case, Senior Airman Vargas. So yeah. He was convicted at a general court-martial composed of members, so jury of other airmen and officers. Two specifications of attempted assault, sexual abuse, three specifications of sexual assault, two specifications of abusive sexual conduct.
And weren't there like four victims in this case as well? I mean, it's not just a one-time thing.
Four different victims. And yeah. Then he was sentenced to confinement for 29 years, reduction to E1, and a dishonorable discharge.
Yeah, so he got rung up really, really hard on a sexual assault case.
That is, I mean, so let's take outside of what happened in this particular hearing. If that's all factually true, we have a number of senior judge advocates and judges in the Air Force who kind of took it on themselves to try to shape the outcome of courts martial and that get this guy acquitted.
Well, yeah, and obviously that was not their goal, but that's the way it turned out. You know, when they try to monkey with the process, you know, just like, you know, Waco and what we're seeing here in Vargas and what we see in UCI cases, unlawful command influence cases all the time, is just naked government ambition and naked government willingness to just set all the rules aside to get the result that they want. You know, and it's an affront to the rule of law, and it's been going on for years and years and years.
Yeah, so in the Vargas case, we have a lieutenant colonel who's the military judge. He had previously served as a military judge in a number of other sexual assault cases.
Right, that's
Article 120.
Yeah, Lieutenant Colonel Levy was that judge. He was not the judge presiding over the court-martial that convicted him.
Right. They convicted Vargas.
Right.
But it seems that a real big swath of, or all the senior SJAs, lawyers for the various commands in Europe, all kind of got together at Ramstein and met with Lieutenant Colonel Levy's boss. And
right.
They
Colonel
all,
Eller.
Yeah, Colonel Eller, and tried to get him removed from all sexual assault cases.
Yeah, because they didn't like the way he was ruling, because he wasn't always in the government's pocket like they want judges to be.
And so in the particular case, he was reassigned in the Vargas case, and then his senior judge, Colonel Eller, then sat as the military judge in that case.
Exactly. And Colonel Eller's job, in my view, was to look at all the SJAs coming to try to get Colonel Levy off cases and telling them to go pound sand. Do not pass go.
It seemed that they were also trying to get him removed from the bench and reassigned to another position.
Yeah. Yeah, we don't like his ruling, so we're instead of appealing it like you're supposed to do if you don't agree with a judge's ruling, well, they're going to backdoor it and they're going to try and get him kicked off the bench because they just want a trial bench full of people who will rule the way that the government wants. It's absolutely disgusting, and it worked in this case, at least until the AFCCA got a hold of it.
Yeah, I want to point out something from the AFCCA's opinion that I found particularly troubling. So the chief judge has been in email communications with the defense counsel of Vargas, and they've been going back and forth about why the original military judge was replaced. And the chief judge here concluded the email by stating, quote, "Requesting interviews with a sitting judge or judges is something for which I would suggest closely reviewing our rules of professional responsibility, state bar rules, etc."
Right. And he's right about that. He just didn't follow his own advice.
But so he is the repository of all this information about why the sitting military judge was removed from the case. And when the defense counsel tries to get information about this, it seems pretty clear that he's threatening them with some sort of professional responsibility action.
Yeah, for going to him and doing what the SJAs themselves apparently did.
Right, and what
it's not a problem when the government does it.
Right, and what the appellate court found that was absolutely that the judge should have recused himself.
Right. the judge being Colonel Eller.
Right.
Who should have shut this thing down at the get-go, never, you know, assuming he didn't shut it down, he never should have gotten on the case himself, because there's no question that he's now a witness in a UCI motion.
And I think this brings up some points for the listeners. Navy, Marine Corps, I think the Air Force is pretty similar on this. But for the most part, a assignment as a judge is a three-year assignment. I mean, you're screened, you go to school for a number of weeks, and then you serve as a judge for just that specific amount of time.
Right. And then you go back into the general...
We just go back into the general pool of being assigned to our next assignment.
Right. With the career goal of most military officers, and that is to make the next rank.
And I think that's a lot of the problems we have in this case. I mean, Lieutenant Colonel Levy is going to have the problem of both his superior and the person who rates him, you know, looking disfavorably upon him, and from looking like he's being removed from important cases.
Right. And apparently you've got Colonel Eller, and I'm not bagging on Colonel Eller generally. I mean, I think he's got a good reputation, but he's certainly not living up to it in this case, because it certainly makes him look like he is, in fact, in the government's pocket. He is more palatable to the SJA cabal that want these convictions. They don't want fair trials. They want convictions. And so they're willing to kind of do almost anything to achieve that goal. And rule of law be damned.
And they don't believe that Lieutenant Colonel Levy will give them favorable rulings. So I believe he's left on one sexual assault case, but he's removed almost immediately from four others.
Yeah, there is absolutely no excuse for that.
So what's the remedy for this?
Well, I mean, the remedy in this case is, you know, the conviction got reversed, and that's good. In terms of an institutional response to these lawyers breaking their oaths and behaving in the way that they behaved. But we certainly have a problem if you are a victim of Vargas's misconduct. His misconduct certainly sounds pretty bad. He ultimately got 29 years for it. The government apparently was able to prove four different victims. Those people also deserve justice, and those people didn't get justice in this case, just like Vargas didn't get it. So, but I do believe he can be retried, and this certainly sounds like the kind of thing that will be retried.
And then those victims get to start over again, right?
That's right. They have to go through this again. And being a victim in a case like this and having to testify, that's not the easiest thing in the world to do. That's incredibly stressful. And, you know, again, lay that at the feet of the government, that these victims have to do that again. Lay it at the feet of the government that once again, our system has embarrassed itself. It's just absolutely unconscionable.
No, and I think that, I mean, both of us have been on both sides of that, either being prosecutors or defense attorneys, and right. Having dealt with victims, it can really be traumatic to have to relive, you know, and it, again, these seem like pretty serious sexual assaults that you have to relive and retell that a number of years down the line. You don't get any finality to that, you know, segment of your life.
Yeah. Yeah. And on what altar have we sacrificed these people's rights to? Well, the altar of, you know, government lawyers and convening authorities wanting to stack the system and game it so that they can get their way, rather than doing everything they can to ensure that a trial is fair. That is their job, is to ensure a fair trial. And they've utterly failed yet again here. And also, I'm reading the tea leaves a little bit, but I also think once again, James, we're going to see no accountability for it.
Right. Well, and here's one of the arguments we have. So how long have you been in your civilian capacity representing service members in courts martial?
In my civilian capacity since 2006.
So in that 12-year span, how many times have you traveled into a war zone to conduct a court martial?
I have never been to a war zone. The closest I got was Kuwait City, And then driving down to Camp Arif John, but that was, I mean, that got me as close as possible, but it's not like there was any firefighting going on.
Right. So, and I bring that up only to kind of debunk one of the arguments you hear against making like long-term military judges, or, you know, judges that will serve for a longer amount of time than just 3 years. Maybe that right. becomes a track, and that we say that we have to be this force that's expeditionary in nature, that we're doing cases all over the world in combat zones, and that we have to have this flexibility to change everybody immediately to take over different positions.
Yeah, that's ridiculous. That's not the way things are set up. It's as ridiculous as the archaic idea that if you're in the Navy, or I guess even in the Marine Corps, assigned to a vessel, that you can't refuse NJP because it's impossible to get somebody off a ship and get them, you know, to a shore command where they can be tried. That may have been true in the age of sail, but it's not true anymore.
I had a client when I was down at MCRD San Diego, his ship was actually at 32nd Street in dry dock the entire time. So yeah. it was really a building laying on its side that yeah. eventually was going to be able to float, but at the time could not.
And the government held him up to not being able to refuse NJP.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, I mean, again, it's not like our system can't operate in a common sense way. You know, it can and it should. And I don't know if it's generally the quality of the people that we're promoting to these positions or, you know, what. Now, I will say, you know, I never was an SJA. I kind of consider that, a badge of honor that I never did that. But right. it also means, I mean, realistically, it means that I may not fully understand the kind of pressures that they're under. But you know what? I can't understand necessarily the pressures that congressmen are under, but that doesn't alleviate the requirement that they behave ethically. I think the same logic applies here. There's no get out of ethics jail free card for an SJA, and nor should there be.
And I served as an SJA, and I still don't really understand it. And I think that I think that we can have a system where, let's say, at the rank of major or lieutenant commander, that we then split off and you decide if you're going to be a prosecutor, defense counsel, or SJA, or if you're going to be a military judge. And then if you're going to be a military judge, that next, 10 years of your career, that's what you're going to do. And I think that that would help some of the problem you had in the Vargas case, I would hope.
Yeah, you know, if you step back and look at the way civilian judgeships, at least the non-elected ones, are handled, the idea is to insulate them from pressures like this as much as possible. You know, don't put judges in a situation where the next whoever's in charge politically, the president or the governor or whoever, can just throw them off the bench. We have lifetime tenure in federal cases. The reason for that is to insulate them from these issues. In the military, not only do we not have that, but we also have an affirmative pressure lots of times to please higher authority, because those are the ones who are going to decide if you get that next star or your next promotion.
Or that you could be working for in a very short amount of time.
Yeah, I want the general to like me. So I'm going to exercise the authority of what I'm doing now in a way that he finds palatable. You know, it's awful when judges do it, and it's appalling when you sometimes hear about defense counsel maybe doing it.
Well, and in fairness, I think that, just to be realistic, the idea that we're going to create any additional Article III federal judges is probably, with lifetime tenure, is outside the realm of possibility.
Right, because people don't serve in the military for the rest of their lives.
But it's really potential, and we already recognize it in the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, where mm-hmm. there are Article I judges that have a 15-year fixed term. Right. So not lifetime, but 15 years is a good amount of time that gives you sure. that insulation from, hey, at least I'm going to serve here, for the next 10 years. Whatever I rule on today probably isn't going to come back to bite me for a while.
Right. And what the military could do is they could create an MOS for military judges that you can elect to stay in for the rest of your career, or maybe would be required to stay in.
Right.
Depending on how they set it up. But there are ways to solve this problem and preserve everyone's right to a fair trial. And you just don't see the institutional push to do it. We seem to be willing to tolerate Vargas cases. You know, we seem to be willing to tolerate Boyce cases, Lewis cases, things like that. We click our tongues and shake our heads, but then nothing seems to change.
I thought for a while the Marine Corps kind of had a stranglehold on this issue because, as you mentioned, the Lewis case from back when you and I served together at Camp Pendleton in the late 90s, and then the Salyer case.
Right.
Let's talk about those for a second, just to kind of give a little background on how this can work and how judges can be attacked in different ways.
Exactly. You know, and the theme is leave judges alone. Let judges do their jobs. If you don't like the way a judge rules, appeal it. If you think that a judge is mentally unfit, well, you know, then there's things you can do to address that. But just looking at a general temperament and thinking, oh, well, we never should have let this guy be a judge because he's not doing everything the government wants, you know, and let's clutch our pearls and wring our hands and figure out some nefarious way to get rid of him. That's not the answer.
And in the Salyer case, I know that there was no professional responsibility actions taken of any of the members in that case. You had a sitting judge who had ruled in a way that the government didn't like about, I believe it was child pornography, what the age of child pornography should be. Is it 18 or 16? He ruled in a way that the government didn't like. Then they go through his private personnel records and determine that he was courting his wife before she turned 18 or something.
Right. And I would also add, you know, he ruled in a way that the government didn't like, but in a way that did make sense and was not, you know, just completely out of bounds.
He ruled in a way that reasonable minds could differ on it. I mean, there is a provision in under the UCMJ that allows a service member to marry a 16-year-old. I mean, so it's not out of the realm of possibility, you know, that his ruling was so extraordinary. But they go through his personnel files and then they try to disqualify him because in the same way that we saw in Vargas, they went to his senior judge and said he should be taken off this case because he may have, you know, courted his wife before she turned 18.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's exactly right. I think a large bit of responsibility for this problem lies with these circuit judges, these senior rating judges who even remotely entertain one
talking,
side.
Oh, yes, I agree with you on there.
You know, I mean, I could see if I were a chief judge and you know, an SJA came to me wanting me to talk about the performance of a judge, my only concern at that point is, you know, are we talking about like some sort of mental fitness issue? Once I realize that's not what it is and that it's just partisan, you know, cajoling me to get rid of a judge who, you know, who hasn't done anything wrong. I mean, I would take that all the way. I would certainly talk to the boss of that SJA who's coming to try to wheedle me on it.
Well, yeah, and to explain for our listeners, for the most part, and I can't speak for the Army on this, but I know Air Force and Navy and Marine Corps, we just kind of divvy up the globe into these regions, and then you usually have a chief judge who is an 06, a colonel or a captain, and then that presides over and details the junior judges. And mm-hmm. And I agree with you. Outside of something along the lines of, hey, wait, you know, we had trial scheduled all this week and your judge never showed up. You know, he was
something
AWOL.
Like that.
You know, something other than that. But anything talking about the rulings or anything else that he was doing, it seems like absolutely off limits.
Yeah.
And in the Vargas case, we not only had something that was off limits, it seems that Colonel Ehlers continued to discuss it with these people.
That's right. And come on the case himself. Well, to kick Lieutenant Colonel Levy off under these circumstances seems to me to be obviously the wrong call. And I would love to know the rationale, and maybe at some point he'll be placed under oath and we'll find out. But I would love to hear Colonel Eller's rationale where he can justify removing him at the request of these SJAs. You know, what would he say?
Right, and that's a good thing to bring up. This case was just decided in the middle of March of 2018. So as we're recording right now, it's the early part of April. So the government still has some time to request the Air Force Court of Military Appeals to either hear an en banc reconsideration. So I think that expires in about 30 days. And then after that, they have the ability to request that the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces take up this case. So we could still get that. I mean, we
could. And if I were representing Vargas on his retrial, I absolutely would insist that whatever rulings Lieutenant Colonel Levy made while he was still on the case, I want those rulings preserved. Whatever he might have said about government evidence or anything else, this should not be a oops, you know, let's all start over again.
Right. Yeah. To make that a one-way ratchet, that if he rules in a favorable way for the defense, you can't just say, well, we get a new judge and now he gets to review everything.
And then they're going to detail, you know, Lieutenant Colonel Hardass to it.
I don't know. This is more of a feeling than anything I can say for sure, but it seems that in the past 5 to maybe 8 years, especially in the sexual assault Article 120 arena, that this has even reached more of a fever pitch. That, you know, if the government isn't getting the outcome they want, they are doing everything they can to try to shape that.
Right. And, you know, let's step back for a second and just talk about promotion issues and fit rep issues and things like that. You have a trial counsel, you've got a victim's counsel, you've got a judge and whoever, you know, whatever other Air Force JAs are involved in this thing. If you just step back and look at the end result of their conduct, they got a significant case reversed. Not because, hey, you know, we made a judgment call and it was the wrong call and things happened in the heat of trial, but no, it was this nefarious attempt to get rid of a judge that they were able to, you know, that worked at least for a time. But what should the system do about these judge advocates who committed this misconduct? I'm just going to call it misconduct because that's what it is.
Right. And no, I agree with you because obviously, I mean, I'm not disagreeing with the outcome or the decision of the Air Force Court, but, you know,
fixed it as best they could.
As far as Vargas not receiving a fair trial because he was denied it. But if he would have, you know, had the original military judge and received a fair trial and was convicted, you're right that you have a very significant, a very significant perpetrator of sexual assault, and his conviction's now been washed away.
Right. And they may, you know, again, they may have trouble trying him again because of this misconduct, you know, as we were talking about. I mean, if a new judge comes on and wants to treat this thing as a brand new case, you know, if I'm on the case, I'm saying, we have to put him back in the position where he would have been had the government not committed this misconduct.
And then you just have the real world problems of, you know, if you're on the government side, that your witnesses, their memories are now another 2 to 3 years older, or they're not in the military anymore. They've wanted to move on with life. You know, that those type of things that really, I think we forget sometimes. And it seems that a number of people forgot here that you've really could disrupt a lot of lives with this.
Well, and I wonder, you know, we can kind of game this out maybe a little bit, because we have these different roles of different players in not just the military justice system, but in the military generally. You know, we're talking about what lawyers do, and we're talking about this screw up that really doesn't affect anyone else in an obvious way, but it certainly is a bad deal on the legal side. What would be the equivalent screw up in an operational command, let's say tank battalion? You know, what type of screw up could someone do in tank battalion that would be the equivalent of getting a 120 case with four victims reversed because of chicanery?
You know, shooting your fellow tanker?
Well, or like running a tank off of a cliff? I mean, what would it be that somebody would just be absolutely, pilloried for doing. That's what we ought to be doing. We ought to treat constitutional issues like this with the seriousness and the severity that they deserve. And we just don't do it. And I don't know why we don't do it.
Well, and I'll tell you, I got to hand it to the Navy. We can see that when they have a ship accident, that they relieve people.
That's a great example.
Yeah, I mean, you could look at the USS Fitzgerald and USS John McCain.
Right.
And
yeah, the heads rolled.
Right, yet you're no longer in charge of this. If your ship runs into something, runs into the ground, any of those things, you're no longer in charge of that ship.
Yes, and this, in our world, in the judge advocate world, to me, this is running your ship aground.
Oh, yes.
You know, this is surfacing your submarine onto a Japanese fishing boat. This is a big deal, and I, for the life of me, I don't understand why we don't treat it as a big deal. I don't know why we don't see headlines, people nefariously screw up rape case, they're BOI'd, they're kicked out of the military.
Yeah, I do think that that's a big problem with us. And to a certain extent, you can understand the trial is a very dynamic environment. And if this case would have been quote unquote lost, or there wouldn't have been a conviction because one of your witnesses just didn't do well on the stand, despite despite you preparing and investigating, if one of your witnesses just recants her story on the stand, of course, that's not a loss. But by the same token, I think we let that go too far, and no matter what happens in a case, nobody's ever at fault.
Right.
And we can see that from Lewis and Salyer, and it looks like we're getting that in Vargas.
We're getting that in Vargas, and you know what? I don't remember the name of the case, but the case where there was a corpsman who was shot in the eye. You remember that case, Santiago, or something like that?
I think, in fact, I wrote about that case. Where
you did?
Where
the federal judge basically said, "Are you people freaking kidding me?"
Yeah, that was a very sad case because there was the interpreter, the possible gunman, and the victim in the corpsman in the tent when he got shot in the face, and for 7 years the Marine Corps did nothing about it.
Right.
And the poor corpsman has one less eye. We couldn't find the interpreter because we know him as Hollywood, and that's all we. He might have been in Top Gun. I'm not sure.
Well, and everybody who had an opportunity to move that issue forward just didn't do it.
Yeah, that was a sad day for us.
And what would be the equivalent of that, for example, in a line battalion?
Yeah,
I don't know the answer, but I'm sure there is some level of screw up that would be treated as harshly as, to me, that ought to have been treated.
Well, and you saw it in the Air Force where it was about 10 years ago, where they didn't keep track of one of the nukes, and it flew from the Dakotas down to Louisiana.
Yeah,
people got fired. You're supposed to kind of keep track of those.
Right. And then, but take a look at what every single military member takes a solemn oath to do. You know, we don't take an oath to keep all the nukes in one place. And we don't take an oath to not run our tanks off of a cliff. We do take an oath to uphold the Constitution. Everybody does it, not just lawyers. But you would think that lawyers or people involved in the military justice system would have a heightened expectation of behavior, not a lower one. But that's what we seem to have.
That's unfortunately true, Brian.
I know.
And I know it saddens us because I think both of us can say we served with so many great people and we made great friendships and we saw a lot of people really trying to do the right thing at all these times. But then there's just at a higher level a lack of desire to really have accountability, in the dual profession of being a lawyer and a military officer.
Yeah. Yeah, and again, I mean, we can beat this horse, all day long, but I don't know what the answer is. I know that there should be an answer. I know what I think the answer should be, but the institutional inertia to holding lawyers accountable for the bad things that lawyers do seems not to exist.
Yeah, and I think for anybody listening, I think probably our two cents is making some sort of track to insulate military judges better than they are, and then true accountability for things like this case.
Right. We can, and I believe by and large we do select judges properly.
Yes, you know, agree.
We're not just pulling people who have no ability or aptitude to be a judge. You know, you and I have both seen good judges and bad judges, but very rarely have I ever seen a judge where I'm just thinking, you have no business being here in the first place.
Oh, no. In fact, quite to the opposite. I agree yeah. with you. I've appeared before some very good judges, and you kind of think to yourself, like, maybe we should let he or she keep doing this for the next 10 years and continue to get even better. Because yeah. I don't care what anybody says. This isn't something that you just step into like, oh, well, I could just be a judge, you know, next week. Or right. And the same way to being a litigator. I mean, there's a learning curve. And mm-hmm. and we've both seen judges that have come back for a second or third tour as a judge and continued to be a better and better military judge.
Right. And I think we should still give good litigators the opportunity to become judges as well. I mean, I wouldn't say to, you know, choose it at the 04 level and now you're where you're going to be and you can't get out of it. I think that you should be able to move from a trial or defense counsel spot into a judge spot. But the issue that you and I are exploring here is once you're in a judge
yeah,
slot,
yeah, I agree.
We
yeah.
have to protect you.
Yeah, that's a good point because it doesn't need to just be at the 04 level, but it's kind of it's once you step over onto that new path that then you don't ever step back.
Right. And we've figured this out by and large on the civilian side. And so there shouldn't be any reason why we have to reinvent that wheel completely. We just have to figure out a way, given that we have actual problems with this, as we see in Vargas and we've seen in other cases, we've got a problem. We know what a good solution is. Is anybody moving to implement it? No, everybody's just sitting on their hands.
And I think that this is something that I would like to see Congress look into, because I think Congress has kind of tipped the scale a little bit right now, being yeah. enraged about not having enough prosecutions in sexual assault cases. And I'm not saying that they're wrong in saying that, but now they've kind of set the table. Now we're getting this that is actually coming back and getting a worse conviction rate. And I think that is something that to not just have the kind of campaign poster about like, well, we want tougher prosecutors throughout the military. Well, maybe we should just look at making a better system throughout the military justice system.
Yeah, and improving what needs to be improved. Because my fear is, and again, I'm more cynical than I wish that I were on this, well, on a lot of things, but certainly this. Let's say Vargas, you know, happened and it really never got discovered until much, much later when it was sort of too late to do anything about it. Would there be any push on the part of Congress, given that a bad guy ended up getting 29 years? Would there be a push to fix this and be concerned about actual fair trials rather than convictions? And I don't think that there would be. I think that Congress has the same problem that these SJAs and these convening authorities have, in a desire to preserve convictions, not necessarily to give fair trials to both accused service members and alleged victims.
You can do both. Yeah, and you're right. That what we're talking about today, doesn't fit into the 280 characters now of a tweet.
That's right.
And it's too nuanced of an issue, and so either the elected representative or its advocacy group, you can't fit it in a tweet, so let's not tackle that.
Right. There's no lobby out there for accused, you know, people accused of sex crimes. There's no lobby out there for people who want to elevate civil rights to the position that they should occupy in our national consciousness.
Right.
There's only a lobby for people for government wanting more convictions. When was the last time, James, that you saw or heard of a judge advocate general certifying an issue to CAF that was a pro-defense issue?
Has it ever happened? I think it has happened, but that's a pretty rare occurrence.
Yeah. Could you imagine a conviction and a harsh sentence, and a judge advocate general looks at it and says, you know what, I'm concerned about the fairness of this trial, so I'm going to certify an issue to CAF that might get our conviction reversed and piss off a victim and pissed off, Senator Gillibrand.
Yeah, I'll tell you, the last time I know of somebody really doing that was now Secretary Mattis when he was General Mattis. I mean, I think that he took some unpopular stances in reversing convictions, but that's the last one I could really talk about.
Yeah, but again, he was a convening authority. I'm curious if the Judge Advocate General, if we've had a JAG who has had enough moral courage to say, yeah, we got our conviction, but man, this ain't right, and we need to make sure it gets fixed.
Right.
Or is it easier just to kind of sit back and say, well, you know, all's well that ends well, and if this guy didn't do this one, he must have done something else.
Well, we're waiting for an outcome on the Navy JAG, but that was covered in a previous program.
Yeah, yeah, the case with Admiral Lorge, the Barry case.
Brian, you have been extraordinarily kind with your time today. Before we go,
yeah,
let's talk about how people can hear Brian Buffard.
Well, I am the host of a radio show that's limited to Fort Worth, Texas regionally, but we stream live on the internet. It's called Uncuffed Radio.
And I've just been binging on it. I really like your format. It's very conversational and kind of, I just listened to your DUI episode and you do a good job of bringing kind of arcane issues to the general public.
Yeah, the whole point of the show is as I was thinking about what I wanted to do with this when I was given the opportunity to have a show, it occurs to me that, you know, if you grow up in America and you're just sort of steeped in our culture and you watch Law and Order and you watch shows like that on TV, cop shows, everybody knows they've got a right to remain silent, for example. But I'll tell you, as a defense counsel, I see so many cases where people are just giving up their right to remain silent for really no reason. And I have so many cases where really the only reason why somebody gets charged is because they ran their mouth. And it just occurred to me that people know what their rights are, but they don't know how to invoke them properly.
I'll tell you, that is amazing, because you see that even with the spate of very senior military officers, you know, you can have General David Petraeus or like Hoss Cartwright do they think they can just talk their way through things or?
Well, and I think there are people who just think that they're smarter than investigators. And if you want to talk about just straight up intelligence, yeah, that might be true. But what you don't have that investigators tend to have is a ton of experience. They are very, very good at getting people to talk to them when they shouldn't. And all it takes is just simply saying, I want a lawyer. And I've talked to so many people and they're just like, well, I feel like if I say that, they're going to think I'm guilty. I'm like, dude, they already think
you're guilty.
You know, it's not a question of, can I say something that will get me out of this arrest? The answer is probably no. You're going to jail. But do you want to go to jail and then not get convicted, or do you want to go to jail and then get convicted? That's your choice oftentimes. So we talk about that, and we talk about criminal law generally, but it's Uncuffed Radio. It's on KFTW FM here in Fort Worth, Texas. And I would encourage anybody to Google us and take a listen.
And then hopefully we can get you to put that up on a podcast one of these days and everybody can listen. But I'll make sure to put all the notes and where they can listen to Uncuffed in its streaming format.
Yeah, that would be great. And I would love to put these episodes up on a podcast so that people can hear them the way they hear your podcast.
Well, thank you, Brian.
Anytime.
Military Justice wouldn't be possible without the fine sound editing by Hannah McCarthy. And this episode is dedicated to the memory of my Uber producer, Dreadnought. You will always be missed out here.